Good afternoon. I'm Gordon Armstrong, and on behalf of Universal Pictures and the production team on The Blues Brothers, I'd like to welcome you here. I'd now like to start the formal press conference by introducing two of the stars of the film, Jake and Elwood Blues, The Blues Brothers, John Belushi, Blues Brothers, John Belushi, and Danny Aykroyd. And also The Blues Brothers director, John Landis. We'll begin the questioning now. Please raise your hand. I'll acknowledge the hand, and we'll have a microphone brought over to you. We can start. Down front, Gene.
And then I want to ask you, how do you think the Blues Brothers will do in Canada, and why isn't the Blues Brothers band going to go to Toronto on their tour?
The first question, I think it'll do fine in Canada. After all, you know, I heard a lot of the music that inspired me, you know, and John to put the band together in the first place in Canada, in Kazabazawa, Quebec. On an old jukebox there, they were playing, you know, all that music in a day when the radio stations weren't, you know, and so I think the consciousness of that music is there, and I think it'll do fine. As far as the band's tour, this tour is like a lean one. We're not playing big houses. I don't think at this point we could fill a Madison Square Gardens or Maple Leaf Gardens.
We don't assume we would.
We don't assume we would. So at this is like a trial run for the tour, and we figured we better keep it, in the United States. I mean, there's possibility for maybe something in Europe and certainly in Canada in the future. And, I know I was lobbying for it in that direction, but everybody felt that we better just keep it in the United States. And, one of the things is the border crossing, I don't know what those boys carry. I mean, hardware, I don't know. But, that's basically it. It's the program was outlined to keep it in the United States and for a trial run to start.
I wouldn't mind playing Toronto or Montreal.
We both. I mean, that's where we conceived of the whole act. I mean, we went to the El Macambo years ago. John came up on a recruiting drive from National Lampoon. He wanted to pick some people up from Second City, and we went to the El Macambo Club and we saw Wayne Cochran and the CC Riders. Now he's a Miami R&B band. We saw this act, and we were just blown away by it, and it sort of sat with us for many years and was really the inspiration, in a large part for this project. And so I hope that answers.
He's from Macon, Georgia, recently.
Can I ask that our photographers please now cut it until the end of the conference, please?
Thank you.
Young lady here.
I'm Dara Wells from NBC's The Source. Downstairs.
What floor?
Fifth
floor.
And eighth. Yeah. Right. We're all over. Could you talk a little bit more about the origins of the Blues Brothers' musical inspiration, how exactly the first skit showed up on Saturday Night Live, if that's in fact where it was first done?
Dan and I used to take cross-country tours from New York to California.
And we'd drive across.
We'd buy a bunch of tapes.
3 days.
And we'd play them. And he'd play me the music that he liked, I played the music that I liked, and we just found that we liked kind of the same type of music and kind of taught each other. And
I think the first time we ever did this was for Bill Bradley.
Yeah.
In New Jersey at a fundraiser that he had, and we played with a band called
Stanky Brown.
Stanky Brown, and they were like a heavy metal band, and of course, tell them you want to do Hey Bartender, and they just jump right in there, and what we did was we brought it into Saturday Night. We never did it on the show, but we started to warm up the audience.
Rocket 88.
Yeah, with a song called Rocket 88, which James Cotton performed. And,
they said, do you like to do the show?
Double park? No. It was like a tool to get the audience warm, and originally he wore this suit as Roy Orbison, the black suit and the shades, and so
also,
he added that.
Yeah, also use it as Shelley Bayless, as a
hip comic,
the most paranoid comic in the world in the early 60s. Comics, hipster comics would wear black suits and black ties, white shirts, to look as much like an insurance
to look as straight as possible.
Straight as possible. Except they wore shades all the time, you know. So which
usually because they were high on coffee.
Yeah. Which would make them look more, even more guilty, and they'd even be more paranoid because of it. So it was actually to try to look inconspicuous.
So it was a cross of the Shelley Bayless suit and the Roy Orbison thing. And
John Lee Hooker always dressed.
John Lee Hooker,
the pork pie hat on
his
album cover.
Famous,
you know,
white
all of these things were components, you know, which helped us put it together. And basically the reception from the audience, actually the guy who signed us to Atlantic, Kleffner, you know, had seen us warm up, and he said, hey, you know, you guys could do an album here. And that's where it all came from. We said, oh, sure, okay, we'll do it. And
then we got the band together.
He put up the money.
you should mention that it was the idea for a movie based on the characters was before
album.
Yeah,
we had the movie before the album came out.
Yeah.
You know, we didn't know what songs we're going to do. We didn't even know what personnel we're going to have in the band. But we knew that there could be a story about these two guys.
We knew what songs. It took a long time to get the songs together. But
no one was prepared for the success of the album.
The personnel was important. The band members were extremely important. It went through everybody to get the right members. Just the right members.
I'm Chris Dan of WPIX-FM. And it sort of sounds like what you were saying about the cross country.
You changed the top 40, didn't you?
Yeah, it's awful, isn't it? But the news is good. I'm the news. sort of sounds like Kerouac and Kesey, or Cassidy of the 70s, you guys barreling back and forth across. What I'm curious about is that shopping mall. Was that real? How many cars did you go through, and what's the Chicago Police Department doing for transportation these days?
Well,
Dan, John, take over.
The shopping mall, in the script, we had, at that point, the police cars and the Bluesmobile went through three stores. And while location hunting in and around Chicago, John Lloyd, our brilliant production designer, found in Harvey, Illinois, a real shopping mall called the Dixie Mall that had been out of business for about 14 years. And we went inside. It was a totally empty mall.
Ghostly.
Yeah, it was kind of creepy in there. Wow. It was like the end of America. But we went in there and spent 3 months dressing it. That's the largest interior set ever built. We spent 3 months dressing it. Also, it's just of interest, there's no breakaway. That's all real glass, real everything. Well, breakaway was too expensive. You know, if you start, I'm serious. You know, breakaway was too expensive and also too complicated. To make big panes of breakaway glass doesn't work. It collapses. So that was all real stuff, and the merchandise was all real. We made deals with many retailers, and they came in and dressed
their
stores.
Insurance companies went, and they made a lot of money.
Well, we had a great deal because all the stuff we destroyed, we had to pay for wholesale. And all the stuff we didn't destroy was returned, and it looks like there's a great deal more damage than it actually is done. And that was shot in 5 days, and how many cars in that sequence, or how many cars?
Altogether,
we purchased about 116
cars. Okay, but
cars.
These are units that the Chicago police had in service. One of them had an average of 75 to 80,000 miles on them, hard city miles.
We only bought actually about 12 from the Chicago police. The others we got from all over the country.
74 Plymouths and Dodges from car lots and, you know.
Yeah, and we used about 120 cars in the movie. We destroyed about 60. Of this, on screen, there are well over 300 collisions. You actually see more than 60 destroyed, but we used the same cars a lot.
Yeah, we recycled body parts.
Yeah, recycled. Bondo. Do you know what Bondo is? We supported the Bondo industry.
Yeah, in fact, the only casualty associated with the driving was a body man who was shot to death outside of the garage in Chicago.
In fact, you know what? You're right. That's right.
That's
true.
Sure.
Well, now, wait a minute. That had nothing to do with us.
Nothing to do with us. It's the debt that he had in his personal life, and he was one of the best body men. And this is Chicago, Illinois. I mean, come on, you know. Chicago, Illinois, New Orleans, Louisiana.
Chicago is my hometown.
We were not there. It's true. We had a car being repaired, and they came in. So where's my car? I'm ready to shoot. They say, well, we can't. You see, the guy's dead. Like, what? That's true.
Yeah.
No, we there were 12 Bluesmobiles. Equipped to do different things. One Bluesmobile, you know when it, you've all seen the movie?
Yeah.
You know the thing when it pulls up in front of Shea Paul?
Yeah.
Which is a completely extraordinary
stunt.
I mean, it's very there are brakes on all four wheels of the car.
Right here, like a tank.
Right, and the passenger is actually steering the car by braking individual wheel. There was another Bluesmobile specially built for jumps.
With bucket seats
and all kinds. There were different cars.
Water and that kind of stuff.
There were six Pintos altogether. We destroyed four Pintos because that's interesting. That's real. When you see that in a movie, by helicopter, we dropped a Pinto 1,400 feet, that's 120 stories, into downtown Chicago. And when you make a movie, we had to prove to the FAA we could do it and not kill anyone. So we had to drop two test Pintos. But we destroyed about 60 cars.
The FAA guy was great. He showed up in a striped shirt with armbands, you know, and a boater and a bow tie, you know. He was...
Well, like in Daly Plaza, we've got helicopters. It's totally illegal. I mean, the helicopter's landing within 6 feet of the Picasso sculpture. And, you know, the guy's going, isn't this great?
Can I follow up on his first saying the Jack Kerouac, Neil Cassidy sort of thing, you were nodding there. Do you have any feelings about that when you guys were barrel rolling across the country? Could you talk about that?
We did a piece.
You don't want to talk about it.
No. We did a piece in Rolling Stone called New South Burn, where we took a car, you know, and went. We covered the election in Atlanta, Carter's election, and you know, there were definite references there to, well, first of all, Hunter Thompson. We tried to imitate his style in writing it.
Not really.
Well, we were talking
to
Gonzo.
Hunter said that was what was wrong with it, because we didn't imitate his style.
Oh, really? Well,
had we imitated his style, it would have been a better article, he said. But I didn't think of it that way.
Well, it was, you know, in our consciousness. I mean, I know you had Kerouac's book in the car because...
No, I didn't. Yes, I read it in college, but I didn't read it.
It was there. We bought that as part of our research aids.
Did you go to Whitewater?
Yes.
Hey.
Yes. Yes.
The Blues Brothers presumably will get out of jail eventually. Do you foresee a sequel to this? That's question one, and then this just a little side question. I couldn't figure why they were having to pay tax on a church-owned orphanage. I thought church property was tax-free.
We want to take that up with Mayor Byrne. We're pretty pissed off about it.
I don't know.
Jake and Elwood are extremely viable characters, and it depends. I imagine if it makes a fortune, I'm sure they'd want them to do a sequel. It's up to them.
Well, that's a good question about the taxes.
Yeah, I'm worried about that the whole
week. Well, in fact, in some counties, they tax orphanages, they tax private foundations, and you know, in that case, they're. It's
a willing suspension of disbelief.
It's Cook County.
It can happen, I believe, ma'am. I think it was the church that was taking over the orphanage for taxes that they had to pay. I don't think it was on the building.
The church apparently was willing to sell the orphanage.
The church needed the money. It wasn't the.
I don't know. I'd write your bishop seriously, because I'm pretty angry about it. I'd look it up.
Over here. Originally, you were allied with Roomful of Blues, and Duke Robillard has said that you guys don't really play the blues, you desecrate the blues.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you get to be with Matt Murphy? Can you explain some of the controversy about Roomful of Blues?
Well, ask Matt Murphy why he wanted to play with us. I think Matt Murphy's a far better guitar player and blues musician than the gentleman you mentioned.
Well, we played with Roomful of Blues at Lone Star Cafe.
And they're fine
musicians.
Good time. Good musicians. I don't know why he's got a hard on for us. I swear.
I think it has to do. I think it has to do with envy.
It might be. He's a fine musician and a fine blues player. He's got a trio now. Duke Romar trio up in Boston. They kicked him out of Roomful of Blues. So.
Are you serious about blues?
Of course I am.
Do you think that John Lee Hooker or Muddy Waters or everyone who supports them and wants to be with them would be with them if they weren't serious about
that upsets me because of the gentlemen who agreed to do the film. I mean, we treat them with respect and the music with respect. The music that came out of the black community was the most creative music, American music anyway. It doesn't come out of the black community anymore. Kingston, Jamaica, or you know, I mean, but for a long time it did. Of course, we have respect for these people.
How far back do you go with them? I mean, how long ago were you listening to blues records, that kind of thing?
About 2 years, honestly. Wheaton, you know? I was mostly into white rock and roll.
Yeah,
heavy
until
metal.
I was turned on to blues, and when that happened for me, it changed my life. So I figured it could help other people too. I mean, we just weren't exposed to it, you know. So once we exposed people to it, they realized how good it is and where most of the music came from.
So it's got to be a thrill to be working with some of these guys just after 2 or 3 years when some of these
guys... Well, we wrote it for them, you know, and hoping they would do it. You know, and then when they did it, it was real exciting.
Yeah. To be
we couldn't imagine doing it without these people, you know.
Being in the same room with them after you idolize them, you listen to their records and all that kind of thing. Still, you guys.
Oh, they're just like anyone else.
I have to. I'll address that. That was something that was quite remarkable about making the movie. Is I'm dealing with, you know, Cab Calloway, who's one of my idols, and James Brown and Aretha Franklin, and it was so funny because when I'm dealing with meetings with them, they were so thrilled to be working with John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd. It was funny. It was like, no, we're thrilled to be working with you. And they're going, no, we're thrilled. It's like, shut up, do your job, get in.
Two questions. Number one, did you ever get the sign back for Triple Rock Baptist? And you still have the ongoing relationship with Jane Burns' daughter, Dan.
I think I only met her twice, as I recall that, Don. As far as I know, let me say this, that she's welcome at our club in Chicago anytime.
Jane Burns helped us out an awful lot. She's a fine mayor of the city of Chicago.
She was very shrewd. Mayor Daley saw a racket squad.
M-Squad.
What's the one with Lee Marvin? M-Squad. In which a Chicago cop was shown getting a bribe, and Mayor Daley announced that Chicago policemen do not take bribes, and there was no filming in the city of Chicago. And Chicago is mostly known because of the riots and gangsters. If you go to Paris and say Chicago, it's Al Capone. And Jimmy Carter, when he was governor of Georgia, did a very smart thing. He brought movies to Georgia, Smokey and the Bandit and things. And what happens is, if you go anywhere in the world, they'll tell you what Los Angeles looks like. They'll tell you what goes on in San Francisco or New York. But they don't know the rest of the country, because there are no movies that come from there. I think John Belushi's love of Chicago is so strong it got obnoxious sometimes. And I think this movie really shows Chicago beautifully. I think that Mayor Byrne is sophisticated enough to understand what it will do PR-wise for Chicago. And also, quite honestly, we dropped, what, $10 million more into the city in a very short time. A film is non-polluting, cleans up after itself. See you later. Here's the cash. You know, they benefited very well. How did you know about the Triple Rock Baptist Church?
I was in Chicago for the film.
Oh, the exterior of that church in South Chicago, that's in South Chicago, and it was called the Plymouth Church. And when I chose it for the location, our art director, John Lloyd, said to the pastor, we'd like to put, it was a black church, he said, we'd like to put neon signs on the front. He said, well, I don't know. And we said, just for the day, and he said, okay, and we shot. He loved those neon signs so much, there is now the Triple Rock Baptist Church in South Chicago. It's now real. They changed the name of the church.
They got the
sign
right up there. Yeah.
And I was upset because I wanted those signs.
Gentlemen, Stu Goldman, Seattle. I would just like to know, are you scheduled into the Pacific Northwest with your band?
I think San Francisco, sir. That's
as far north.
Yes, sir.
Okay. And Denver.
Okay, thank you.
Ed?
John, I just wonder, when you said black music changed your life, what do you mean exactly?
I mean blues music, actually, because I was involved with, I'd been a musician most of my life, you know, at least playing in bands, but rock and roll bands. I mean, I'm coming from Chicago, but outside the city of Chicago, you didn't really go into those neighborhoods, you know, as a white kid from the suburbs. You listened to the radio and went to little clubs outside the city. So when I was exposed to this music, especially blues music, Magic Sam, John Lee Hooker, Muddy Waters, actually it was while I was filming Animal House, and seeing it live on stage was exciting to me because people were actually dancing.
He became messianic. You know? When we were promoting Animal House in Chicago, he dragged Tim Matheson and I down to see Fenton Robinson, who was great.
Yeah.
No, he really did.
To see people get up and dance, you know, and have a good time to live music, that's what really turned me on, to see that happen again. As opposed to disco, I mean, I didn't like disco, and I was a little tired of rock and roll where it was, you know? I mean, how many Rod Stewart albums can we listen to? You know, I just couldn't. So there was something missing. And I figured it was something was missing from everyone else's consciousness too. I just assumed that. I mean, I figured if I liked it, there must be at least 20 people out there who liked it too, you know?
I mean,
if it would turn on and it would change people that much, I mean, it's almost like religion, you know? It's just something, it's a new interest.
See, you were inspired by Curtis Salgado's band, and I was inspired by the Downchild Blues Band of Toronto. Mm-hmm. And the Lamont Cranston Band of Minnesota.
A lot of white bands.
Minnesota. These are all white bands that go out and do this
Delbert
music.
McClinton.
Delbert McClinton.
It's Texas Rhythm and Blues.
Wayne Cochran, you know.
And we just weren't around. It just, you know, during those early times. I mean, I know a lot of people from Chicago had seen all Butterfield and Bloomfield and Muddy Waters and Sun Seals and all those people that I just never saw.
Muddy Waters, unfortunately, he was in the film. And he was singing a duet with John Lee Hooker out there on Maxwell Street, and he became ill the night before shooting. He was very sick, and it's a great
Horton's in it. Big
great
Walter Horton's in it. Pine Top
disappointment
Perkins.
To us that he couldn't do it. That's his band, but he couldn't do it. It was really sad.
Let's see if it's me.
Dennis Messer from Pittsburgh. When I see you folks work together, and there's a chemistry, and how does the creative process work? I mean, if one person gets an idea, do you jump on it? Are you critical of it? How does it work, in fact, when you come up on a project and it evolves between the two of you?
Between two of us?
Yeah.
Well, there were a lot more, you know, people involved in ideas and thought and creativity in this one.
Well, Dan did most of the writing. Well. You know, he's the real workhorse here.
Well, that's true between us. I mean, you know.
He would hit me with, "Well, what do I do here?" You know, and I'd say, "I don't know. Make him a maitre d' in a restaurant." You know, and all of a sudden, the next day, he'd have five pages on it. And you know, sometimes the ideas would be lame, and they'd just say, "That's lame." Or, but Dan's very polite. He's a gentleman.
You see, Danny writes it, and it's a linear
thing. Most important thing.
You do it, though, and see how it feels, like a musician might try a riff, they might play a lyric.
We've done this so many times, you know. I mean, musicians have riffs in the back of their heads that they've done for years. You know, we've got tricks that we've learned on stage over the years that we know it'll work and know won't work. We're both at Second City. You know, we know that it's not real jokey. There are not a lot of jokes in the movie, you know, because we don't like them.
Now, the movie stands and falls on whether you like Jake and Elwood. I mean, they're pretty low-life hoods, you know. I mean, they're pretty shambling.
Well, no, I excuse me. They are.
But you have to like them. They're
well-meaning. They are role models.
You see, this is what we do
criminals.
When we disagree.
Say that word again.
They are sociological role studies of recidivist criminals.
Which
they
means low-life hoods. The difference. No, but they are very
offenders.
But they are very innocent and very sweet and very sympathetic. And the movie stands and falls on whether John Belushi and Dan Aykroyd can create characters that we will like and care about. You know, and
that's the director's point of view, which is true.
Would you like to see the Blues Brothers maybe become the new American heroes, since there may be such a void here in that?
I don't think
we don't really go for that.
That would be a burden I don't think that we're willing to bear at all.
Not at all. Let's leave that to Bruce Jenner.
That's right.
Danny said Animal House started this rash of toga parties. And we're terrified now that people are going to start driving through malls, you know. So. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Steve North from WLIR on Long Island. Yep. And I'm wondering, judging from this movie and 1941 and Animal House, from all the destruction there, can we take from that the possibility that beneath these passive exteriors there's a little bit of volatility in your personalities?
Charles Chaplin or the Marx Brothers or Laurel and Hardy or Buster
Max Sennett.
I'm wondering if this is a cathartic experience for you. Does it?
I don't get a thrill out of driving at high speeds and making 180 degree turns. I don't get a thrill out of that. He does. I don't. I don't think that's fun. It's not my idea of fun.
Did you in the movie, you know, in Lower Wacker, when they're underground there are about seven shots where the car is independent, where Aykroyd's actually driving at about 60 miles an hour, followed by 30 cars, and John was not happy about it at all. And in fact, there's great looks on his face, like, get me out of the fucking car. Mm. He's a good driver.
I might say that one of the reasons that we had to do this movie when we did it is because that the Chrysler Corporation has thrown away all those body dies. They do not make those cars anymore. Those cars are not cast anymore. That's the last of the big Dodge, you know. So stunt drivers feel, you know, much more comfortable working in those big cars than they do in, say, an Aspen or you know. So I mean, that was one of my, you know, principal reasons, was to utilize the last of the big Chrysler body dies. Okay, anybody from Detroit here?
We were terrified about the gas shortage. In fact, do you remember that? Going into Chicago, we were busy making arrangements for our own direct gas line, because last summer was when, oh God, there's going to be no gas. But it didn't happen.
All right.
Hi, Becky Gordon, RBQ, Tampa. Why wasn't the movie premiered in the logical city, which would have been Chicago?
Can I answer that? We were going to have a premiere. In fact, Monday we are going to Chicago.
That's
to
what
show
I'd like
it,
to know.
Show it. To, there is no premiere. We decided the premiere worked out, and it came out to a great deal of money, and instead, Mr. Belushi, Mr. Aykroyd, Universal Pictures are giving the city of Chicago $50,000 cash to be used. Thank you. But to be, quite honestly, we found it offensive to spend that kind of money on a party.
Yeah.
So it's going to orphanages, yeah. We are going to Chicago, we are showing it to people who worked in school. We'll be there Monday. And definitely we're going to Chicago, we owe them a lot.
I don't like those openings. Do you? You don't like those.
Have you ever been to premieres? They suck.
No. There's no reason for it.
Could you explain how Twiggy got involved in the movie?
She was a woman like out of nowhere in the middle of Illinois with United Kingdom license plates and the Jaguar. It was just like she was from outer space.
Twiggy's a cultural icon of the 60s. I mean, yeah. She is Twiggy. I mean, she's very few people have that kind of impact on culture. And Elwood is making time, and we just, what is the most alien thing to Elwood that we came up with? She shows up, though.
Yeah, it's very nice. Are we pointing to anyone?
Who's pointing? Are we
Gene,
pointing?
Go ahead, and then I will take you over.
The question there, then, to John. Do you feel nostalgic, or you feel upset or sad about leaving Saturday Night Live?
I think that we fulfilled the parameters of 3-minute late night TV bits quite adequately. I found that in my last year there, I was repeating stuff that I was doing. We had gone to as far out as we could. You know, we had, I think, done our job there. Really, it was just a matter of getting out, and he was doing Samurai just a little too much, and the Coneheads were just like a little wearing thin. I think that we left at exactly the right time.
I feel certain sentimental about Saturday Night Live, of course. I think it was the best show on television. And the reruns are still better than anything on TV. So
we missed the gig, the job, the 78-hour work week.
It was hard. It was hard, we think of the good things of Saturday Night Live, but it was actually a pretty hard job. And I get pretty emotional when I see it. When I left it, I kind of broke up a little bit, I was a little upset. But knew we had to leave.
There's talk it won't be back.
Just talk. Won't be back. Lauren will be. Gene Demanian is the new producer.
The show is going to change quite a bit.
It'll change. It'll be back, but I'm going back just to be the drummer in the band.
You've played characters for so long. Were there any problems with or anecdotes related to getting the musicians in the movie to play characters?
You mean which musicians?
You mean the band?
Or Aretha Franklin?
Aretha had never acted before, and as a novice actress.
Her husband's a fine actor.
She's a great performer. She's married to Glenn Turman, who's a fine actor, and he coached her, I think, because she showed up well prepared. I don't know. The band, none of the band, of course, had acted before, but they're all, Steve Cropper and Duck Dunn and Matt, those guys have all been performers for years.
Steve Cropper and Duck Dunn were Booker T and the MGs, and responsible for most of Stax Records, worked with Johnny Taylor and Sam and Dave and Otis Redding especially,
In Paper Moon, Bogdanovich used real people from that town that he was shooting in, and they looked good. I think we were all pretty confident, anybody can act, really.
Well, it's a
come
hard,
on.
Especially in a movie when you can cut out the bad part.
Come on.
When you do a musical, you have to, when you're doing a musical number that requires dance, it pretty much has to be pre-recorded because otherwise.
You got Farewell, My Lovely.
When you do.
Sorry, Peter.
Otherwise, it will not be in sync when you do another take. In the movie, James Brown's number was recorded live. John Lee Hooker's number was recorded live.
Yes.
And the parts of the concert and stuff, but this is a traditional movie musical. You can't fuck around. It's got to be, if you're out of sync, it's not going to work. You're in terrible trouble. I mean, Singing in the Rain, The Wizard of Oz, The Blues Brothers, the technique of making musicals has not changed that much. This is not a filmed concert.
It's the same. It's like in All That Jazz. Remember that? They said playback, you know, you have to do the playback and start, stop, you hear it over again.
Andy Francis from Us Magazine. Would you just comment a little? You said the first album was a complete surprise, the success of it, on how that is what you said a little earlier, that the first album taking off, and it was really thought of as a movie concept first anyway, and also how you did put the band together, actually.
Before the album came out, we came up with the movie, but we came up with the band, the songs, the gig at Universal, recorded it, and while it was being mixed, we came up with a movie idea. That was before it was released.
Well, that's not true. I flew to New York long before that. Ernie, which was it? Am I right or am I wrong?
We didn't even know it was going to be in the band. We didn't know that it was, we were going to do an album. We had the commitment already to do the album.
And we had recorded the album.
No.
After we had
No, the album wasn't even done. This is prior to the Universal Amphitheater.
Prior to the amphitheater, we
Who
were talking
cares?
About
yeah, prior to the amphitheater. Yeah, right.
No, the success of the album, the over, it's double platinum, or what is it?
Right.
2.8 million.
The success of the album made everyone more anxious about the movie. Suddenly, can you have a movie June 20th? Sure!
It went double platinum. I don't think it was a surprise to me. I mean, yeah. I just don't have it in my mind that it's going to fail. You know, you just can't go into a project thinking it's going to fail.
Well, how did you get Duck Dunn and Steve Cropper? I mean, did Mike
I called him up late one morning. And I said, actually, Phil Walden is the one who told me to get them, because I was looking for people, and a friend of mine, Mitch Glazer, said, get those guys, and I said, God, I don't know. Maybe I'll get Elliot Randall and Will Lee, you know, someone else. And so I asked Phil Walden, what do you think of Steve Cropper and Duck Dunn? He said, get them. I said, but he said, don't even think about it, get them. So I called him that night, and I told Steve that, well, I gave him some on the phone, I said to... I called Duck, and he didn't think it was me, and I said, I understand you don't get along with Steve Cropper, you know, and he said, oh, I do. I said, no, I don't want any fights in this band. No. I called Steve, and I said, now you're going to play rhythm guitar, okay, because we've got Matt Murphy's going to play lead. He said, I like playing rhythm guitar. I said, all right. So it worked out great. You know, I was a punk about the whole thing. I really came in with an attitude.
Just like in the movie.
Like in the movie, I guess.
Steve and Duck have played together since high school, right? Or
yeah.
Earlier.
Yeah. Steve played first, then Duck learned to play bass to hang around with Steve.
All the way in the back.
Yeah. How much did the movie cost to make?
$27 million is what it cost Universal Pictures.
All right, I'm disturbed about a couple of things, but mainly the editing. Were you satisfied with that?
Yes.
It seems out of sync in some sequences.
Did you see it last night or the night before?
I saw it last night.
No, I can't. We were unhappy with the projection and the sound at that theater, but I'm very happy with the movie, so...
All right, so what we saw last night then could be the fault of the theater.
I'm not supposed to say anything about it. Go see it at the Gemini. Please, if you saw it last night, see it again in another theater.
Of that 27, did you say 27 million?
27 million bucks.
10 of that you attribute to reconstructing...
No, not spent in the city of Chicago. Wait a minute. It spent in, at least $10 million was spent in the city of Chicago. When you make a film...
Creating jobs.
I mean, that's money that created jobs and business for Chicago. When you make, for instance, we had a crew, I think a hardline crew of how many people? 200 people. Well, at least half of those people come from Los Angeles, so that means you have to put them up in hotels.
Right.
You have to give them per diem. When you do a dance number... You have to rehearse the dances for 2 weeks.
A sunglass.
You know, and sunglasses, very expensive. No, but quite honestly.
So you spent $10 million in addition to the $27 million.
No,
how much?
No, ma'am. The movie cost $27 million, at least $10
million. And that includes, okay.
Of course.
How much did it cost to put Chicago back together? Let's put it that way.
Well, that's all built in there. That's built
into
the cost.
That's all built in there.
Well,
okay.
$5 million
to destroy
it, $5 million to put it back together.
Okay.
You have to look. You have to realize this is a union picture, which means that we have to deal with the Teamsters, we have to deal with the IA. It's not cheap to make movies.
I was only asking for an explanation.
No, well, if you want to know, you want an education in filmmaking? To make Animal House cost $2.6 million 2.5 years ago. To do the identical film right now would cost close to $10 million. Motion picture production has gone up over, 300, 400% in less than a year.
Labor rates, price of gasoline, price of electricity.
I mean, quite honestly, if you pay your own price of actors. No, but quite seriously, what happened in the movie business is real interesting. The nude bomb cost $9 million, and that's not out of line. It's a studio-made product. Pictures cost a fortune. You notice you're paying $5 for movies now. Have you bought groceries lately? The motion picture industry is in an interesting position. It's no...
The F-14 costs $30 million.
If you want to go to comparisons, they're giving $29 million to Carter, $29 million to Reagan. I think we'd be hard-pressed to find a smile in any one of those bucks. I mean, okay... All right, those monies are to move the electoral process of the United States of America along. America likes to relate to the boss. I don't know.
No, quite laugh.
I mean, I think Universal was upset that it cost $27 million.
Universal was upset we showed up. No, quite honestly, that's not true. In fact, they were very supportive to it. But quite honestly, the cost of a movie is what it cost, and in terms of the Blues Brothers, with 6 weeks pre-production, to make what is in fact one of the largest movies ever made. If you look at it again, you'll notice it's a bigger picture than Ben-Hur, and they took 3 years to make Ben-Hur. It's a bigger picture than Lawrence of Arabia. They took 2 years for that. We have literally well over 10,000 people on the payroll.
Bigger than Lawrence?
That movie. Oh, sure. Oh, yeah, look at Daily Plaza again. But but quite honestly, in terms of how much it cost, I will not ever apologize for spending money to entertain. I'm sorry.
That's true.
I mean, I feel very good about it.
What about money spent for mind-altering substances?
Mind-altering substances? Yeah. You're talking to the straightest person of all time.
That's for damn sure.
No, really. He drinks, he's on sugar, man. Dr. Pepper, that's it.
Diet Dr. Pepper.
Diet Dr. Pepper.
Got here. Question might, I think the question would be just, how much did you budget for destruction of property? In the making of the picture, just a ballpark.
My property.
No. Seriously, I couldn't give you a ballpark. We'd have to break down the budget. I know that. For instance, in our deal with the city of Chicago and Daily Plaza, we shot that whole sequence on Labor Day weekend, on a Saturday, Sunday. That whole sequence was shot in 3 days. And for instance, the deal was when people show up Tuesday, they won't know we were there. And in effect, I must tell you that it's a movie, and. Thanks to me, I guess, and my talented co-workers, you think you saw a lot more than you saw. How many soldiers do you think there were in Daily Plaza? There were 200 soldiers in Daily Plaza. It looks like 1,000. I mean, that's what we do for a living. I mean, a movie is images. In terms of destruction, yeah, we really screwed up the mall. There's a lot of destruction in there.
But that place was, you know, bankrupt and
And we also had to restore it. In fact, every single location we used was in much better condition when we left.
We had to scrub the tire marks off the floor. I did some of that. No, that's okay.
I'd love to have some figure, but
I have
no idea.
Yeah, I'd love to know about that. And did that cause you any qualms in these days of shortage?
Yes, we were very concerned going into Chicago. Yeah, oh, my God, there's going to be a shortage. Call Standard Oil, do something. But there wasn't. If you recall, it didn't happen. They raised the prices, built this, and something.
No, I didn't mean that. I mean, did you ever stop and think, well, hang, maybe we better use a few less cars and save some of this gasoline?
Oh, no, do you know anything about... No, a stunt car... Well, I'll correct you there, too. A stunt car. A car that does a stunt... There's no gas tank in there. You take the gas tank out, I'm not going to kill anybody. Right. There's less than a gallon of gas in those cars. You have a little tiny thing in the trunk because we're not out. Stuntmen.
The bulk of the gasoline went to tractor trailers.
The Teamsters.
You know, straight trucks that haul generators and all that stuff.
No, the biggest. How do I stress it? One of the major accomplishments of this film. There are more stunts in this movie than any movie ever made, and we had the most severe injury we had was one stuntman got 3 stitches in his chin.
Yeah.
It's quite a feat. No one was hurt. Those stunt cars are safe.
And he wouldn't put his belt on. He told me
that was his fault.
Also, the grade of gasoline that we were using.
He wouldn't do it.
We were using we were using a raw gas there. I mean, like bottom of the tank because we got it.
All those cars are junkers. I mean, you take out the gas tank. You replace the plexiglass. They're strapped in. I mean, that's an interesting thing. Most of those stunts pose no real danger. Even, you know, the pile up under the L? Those cars are reinforced and stuff. You can be in that car and smash up. You won't get hurt. You're all strapped in. However, these men are so skilled. The driving is exceptional. You've got to hit at exactly the right place to give me what I want and flip correctly. Gary McLarty, our stunt gaffer, did a brilliant job.
the stunt coordinator.
Right here, and then we'll go out to the table here.
John, you said the blues changed your life 2 years ago. Was there a particular club performance or record?
Yeah, it was at the Eugene Hotel watching the Robert Cray Band.
Is Dan serious about, are you serious about the blues too?
Well, I mean, look, man, you know.
Serious.
I mean, what can
you
I say?
You can't be serious about everything. It's like being a serious actor, they say, well, when are you going to do serious parts? Well, I consider comedy pretty serious, you know, what I do pretty serious. There are plenty of actors that make people cry. You know, it's hard to find them that'll make them laugh.
I'm serious about, I'm seriously concerned about.
There's a lot of things involved with that.
I'm seriously concerned about a guy like Walter Horton.
Yeah.
Who plays, perhaps, he's the last of the electric blues harp players, and I'm concerned that he, you know, can barely get it together to get an album deal, or, you know, the clubs he's playing are like these minimal bars and stuff. That concerns me.
And, years
what can I say? I mean, I've supported him out of my own pocket. And he doesn't know that.
Because of John and Danny, we brought huge 26-track trucks down to Maxwell Street to record these people. We found Walter Horton. It took a detective to find him.
Yeah,
we found him to put him in the movie. I mean, these guys, yes, they are serious. That's the answer.
Carrie Bell, Walter Horton.
Wait a second, just a gentleman.
Albert Collins. I mean, these great people are in Chicago. Great musicians.
Am I the gentleman behind?
You're the gentleman behind.
Of the Blues Brothers' talents, I personally prefer the dancing over anything else. Your act, Mr. Aykroyd, seems to be impromptu. Is it impromptu, your dancing, or in the movie did you have to have a regimen?
We worked with a choreographer to do it as best we could. You see, you got to remember about the Blues Brothers. You see, the best part of the Blues Brothers is the band. We are front men. You know, and although, you know, our talents as vocalists and dancers, you know, might not be as you know, as best as they, you know, we are limited, definitely, in that area.
You're not Ben Vereen or something.
No, we're not Ben Vereen. It's not. I mean, I think in a movie like Fame, you will see far more skillful dancing. Because
the Blues,
you know,
Brothers is not about skillful. You're responding to the exuberance and what Aykroyd's doing up there. It's wonderful. And yes, John and Danny worked out Jake and Elwood moves during the concerts. Our very fine choreographer, Carlton Johnson, worked with them and basically used a lot of their stuff. And yeah, when you make a movie, you have to do it again from different angles. So it's not, when people tell you they make things up, that's not true.
These
are very hardworking guys.
On stage, we don't. The choreography is usually worked out in rehearsals between Dan and myself, and we really don't know what we're doing most of the time. We just try to feel what the music will bring us. You know.
Did you do your own flips, somersaults?
I did all my own flips. Sure.
Really?
Sure.
Go ahead. Way in the middle table there.
I lie to you.
I just got the feeling you really had your heart in this movie. So meticulous from the Sam and Dave tape going into the cassette machine. The Bluesmobile. I mean, everything is just together. Like, how much time did you spend in? I mean, going into town, just looking it over.
Years.
Well, I've been. I worked in Chicago at Second City, and I've been bouncing from Toronto to there. Quite a bit. I've been through that town a lot, so I know it. I mean, Maxwell Street, I discovered years ago and used to hang out. Maxwell Street is only alive, like you saw it in the movie, at about 6:30 to 11 on Sunday mornings. You know, you have to get up real early to catch it. So it was just a more or less, you know, a compilation of my experiences there. The Bluesmobile, you know, he bought it at a police auction, and that's where I used to go to those a lot, you know.
And something else I noticed that's different from most musical types of movies is that you brought the characters, they had their own thing, and they were brought in with their musical abilities, which is different from any other movie that I've seen.
Well, our musical abilities, such as they are, I think basically went into this knowing that we would have a lot of great, talented people. I mean, the real artists, the real R&B artists in this movie.
It's exposed a lot of people.
And also the band, I mean.
To let them know about.
You know, our reason, our raison d'etre, if you will, is the band, is the fact that we feel we have really a solid smoking R&B blues band here, and you know, we're happy to go out there in front for them.
We have a wonderful time.
Yeah.
This guy again?
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
When I made mention of the station before, you said something about the top 40 aspect of it.
Yes, sir.
And if you erase my reply to that so I can hang on to my job.
Yeah.
Down there. I came in after that happened. You brought up a subject in terms of the artists that appear in this film and the fact that a lot of the older artists got ripped off of their publishing and so on. It appears the radio has been closing up as an outlet for that kind of material. I know radio's been real good to you guys with your album and so on, but in the blues itself, you don't hear it on the radio very much anymore.
You won't hear
John Lee Hooker on the radio.
Blues is R&B, there's Memphis, there's Motown.
That whole genre, though. But John Lee Hooker, you're not going to hear him anywhere except maybe a Pacifica radio station someplace.
You might now.
You got anything to say about the state of radio in terms of exposing these artists and music now?
Well, that's part of why we made an inroad somewhere where
they can be exposed. They never really have a lot.
People just have to be reintroduced to it. They have to go, hey, we got a Sam and Dave album in our library. Let's pull it out. You know, it's just no accident that you cut
to the label, Sam and Dave.
You know, people have to do it themselves. It's not all the radio. The radio.
It's the programmer and the jock who has to like it.
Depend on the radio. If I depended on the radio for my music, I would never. We never would have done this. This movie.
Right, but how about that?
Well, how about radio? I mean, what's wrong with that?
That's the question I'm asking you. How about radio? What do you think about it?
Well, a lot of it depends on the artist.
I love the radio stations that play my record. it's got its faults, just like television, just like any other media. You know, I'm not going to knock radio. It's easy to do that. Everybody does that.
You know, there's
like knocking television.
There's a tremendous movement. You know,
movies or big budget movies or. But I think we've made some kind of inroad in there. They're playing more Sam and Dave, more Spencer Davis, more things like that, more Wilson Pickett. And if we can just make a dent somewhere, you know, we're happy.
Are you going to break one of the, like the Aretha cut as a single, as opposed along with your single, whichever it'll be? Or?
Well, you break one at a time, you know.
Yeah, sure. Yes.
Probably. Yes?
Yes, they are, yeah.
Oh.
And they're all on the album.
Lou Simon from Waze Radio in Charlotte. First of all, with no apologies to Billy Sherrill or Tammy Wynette, I think that Stand By Your Man was one of the high point musical numbers. I don't know if that was impromptu or what. Other interesting point from Atlantic Records' standpoint, I think, will be that the single, Give Me Some Lovin', is never completed in the film, to the best of my recollection. But
talk to him.
That's
the real
right.
Question I wanted to ask was the role of the mystery lady.
Okay. Every.
Why was that? Why was that there?
Okay.
You know,
every
Fisher's
blues
wonderful.
Man. A lot of blues men. Well, have ladies. I'm not going to mention names here because there's some ugly situations that have happened where ladies have dumped hot grits, shot or knifed their men. They're blues men.
You think some of the great
some of the great R&B and some of the great blues artists. I mean, the people who know music. Well, you know, we'll know the three people I'm talking about.
Al. Wow.
Well, I'm not going to, let's not mention it.
No mention.
You know, but they, there are ladies gunning for blues men, and this is like, you know, part of the Odyssey, and...
Robert Johnson.
She was slighted, and...
don't mention.
She actually just showed up with her weapons, and we just...
We hoped it would be funny.
Yeah, that first weapon she had looked like a Star Wars type thing.
That's a real weapon. That's an M.
That's a
what's it
law rocket.
A law.
It's a Navy. Navy.
We didn't write the part for that.
Anti.
No.
Anti Corvette.
In fact,
weapon.
Another actress was supposed to do that role, and there was a conflict, and Carrie became available. And
who was supposed to do that?
None of you are busy. No, honestly, she got a much larger part in another film.
No, Shelley Winters was supposed to.
All right. Shelley Winters. Shelley was offered a better part.
Go ahead.
Right. When you first went to Chicago and proposed to the Chicago police and authorities, Jane Byrne and all, that you wanted to go in and do 90-mile-an-hour chase scenes through town mm-hmm. and sort of terrorize the city, what was their reaction to that?
They asked how much money we were going to spend.
Also, we didn't tell. All that stuff was shot on Sundays. And, in fact, the city of Chicago really didn't know what was going on. And I was quite surprised by the press in Chicago in that we asked them to stay away, and they were very, you know, we want to see, and they saw couldn't believe it. They didn't. I mean, you saw what we did in Chicago. They got hardly any of it. But the they were very. The Chicago police was exceptional to us.
Yeah, you got to remember when the car drives through Daly Plaza, bang, we did that one cut, then cleaned everything up, and then did the drive through past the lobby, and that was one segment.
Yeah, the people who came to work too. I must tell you, it's something we look forward to when we show this movie in Chicago. People are going to go, why? Because they had no idea it happened. And they were tell them about meeting Mayor, when we our first meeting with Mayor Byrne.
She's wonderful, Mayor.
She says, is there anything we can do? And I said, yes, I'd like to drive a car through the Daly Building. And she turned to her aide, can they drive a car through the Daly Building?
And he went, sure,
yeah, okay. Also, we asked about the pizza, where to get a good pizza.
Yeah, that's right.
She had like six
guys. A lot of New Yorkers in the bands. Can't get a good pizza in Chicago. Can't get a good pizza in Chicago.
And she said, where can we get a good pizza? And it was like, yeah. People were running around.
All these aides are going, calling out names.
It tastes like cornbread.
I think the movie's pretty respectful to the city.
It better be.
I'd like to direct this question to John. You were talking about costs before, and he was talking about costs, and you said paying the actors. Do you stand to get more of a percentage out of this film than you did out of Animal House? Has that improved because of the success of Animal House?
When you make a deal, you make a deal. You can't go back on it,
But has it improved for you? Has the success of Animal House... I can't answer that question for you.
Say yes.
Yes, sir. Yes. Yeah. I mean, of course.
I think what happened is salary.
It does. Not my fault. It's my manager.
He got his own Winnebago.
I'm not trying to make funny, but yes, you do get more money. The more successful the films,
right.
You see. You have to pay them back to 1941.
Yes. Yeah. We listen. I want to say right now. I was proud to work on 1941. I like that. I like Spielberg.
I like Spielberg and 1941. I've got nothing to be ashamed of.
Yeah, really. It didn't lose money, right? It's big in Japan. So
we did it.
Don Cox, 100 Miami. Having lived in Chicago when the movie was made, I just want to make a comment. The people in Chicago did not feel it a sacrilege that you ran through the Daily Center and all that. What do you attest to the fact that you did to make the people in Chicago allow this phenomenon to happen?
Well, it was mutually beneficial.
We asked them. Yes, yeah. It was mutually beneficial. It's possible to do things just to be nice to a city. I think Chicago is a real gem. I mean, it's a real creative center.
I think RJD did some twists in his grave, though,
Mayor Daley probably wouldn't understand it, perhaps.
Well, Mayor Daley said Chicago policemen, don't take
bribes. There are
no
some bad cops, but not all of them in Chicago. I want to make that clear, too. There are bad cops in Miami and Charlotte.
No, you're right. The city was exceptional to us.
You should pick on Chicago. I think this is a movie to show Chicago as a beautiful city, a creative city.
Very beneficial relationship both ways.
No, we had a very... Did you read the end credits? I don't know if you read the end credits. That's very serious. They were exceptional to us, and I think it was very good.
Two more questions, and we have to call the young lady in. And
this chick.
Yeah, talk a little bit more about Sam and Dave. I don't think it was accidental that the very first musical...
That came out of Steve Cropper and Duck Dunn. They played on that record when he played Steve at
Soul
Steve
Man.
Cropper. He played on Soul Man. When we went into rehearsals, that was not on the list. I did not assume that we would be able to do that song. I did not assume that I could sing like Sam or Dave. And they forced me to do it. And they encouraged me. I got the encouragement from those people.
The use of it in the film is a sign of respect to Sam and
yes.
Dave. It's also great music. It can't hurt your movie.
How about this? Okay.
John has somebody in mind.
Since the Blues Brothers album sold almost 3 million copies, how do you feel about the fact that the mass acceptance has been towards your version of the blues? Do you believe that people will realistically then go out and buy the originals of some of these songs?
Well, I mentioned it on the album. I don't know if you heard the album.
The new one?
No, the old one.
The old one?
I say after Soul Man, I suggest you go out and buy as many blues albums as you can.
No, in fact...
And I mention each person who did the song originally, before the song, and I mentioned each member of the band. Hopefully that's what we were trying to accomplish.
Have you spoken to, for instance, any fans that have told you that as a result
Yes, they have. A lot of them have gone down to see a lot of blues, like on Lincoln Avenue in Chicago. I have.
I have, yes, ma'am.
This is the last question, I'm sorry.
One of the things I noticed in the film, one of the things I liked, was that after Jake gets out of prison, Jake and Elwood are always physically together in all the scenes, never more than 10 or 15 feet away from each other, never in separate rooms. Was that intentional?
Well, here are two guys that sort of had, you know, it's like Jake had no place to stay. I mean, what's Elwood going to do? Let his brother...
It's a typical brother relationship.
Yeah,
we barely get along.
People have been married too long, you know, kind of, you know.
You know,
a little tolerance on either, you know, on either side. But I think, yeah, definitely that was intentional that they spend that time together.
Thank you very much for coming, John, Dan.
Thank you.
Thank you.